This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 24th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me Marianne Davidson. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning.
Marianne Davidson is the CSO of Oracle and a strong proponent of software security. Marianne holds an MBA from Wharton and a BS in mechanical engineering from my alma mater, the University of Virginia. She served as a Navy officer in the Navy Civil Engineer Corps for 3 years and comes from a long line of Navy people, her dad having served as dean at Annapolis. She's also a surfer and a skier whose nickname is the Queen of Trim, and she lives most of the time in Idaho. You can see her blog at blogs.oracle.com/Marianne Davidson. So the first question is a very short question, but a rather important one, and that is, what exactly does a CSO do?
Well, there goes the rest of the podcast. you know, it really depends on what I can't speak to what every other CSO does, and in fact, I have sort of a strange title for what I do, but I think it's in a way a good title for what I do. My focus is actually on product security. It's not on operational security. It would
right.
be too much to do both of those, and fortunately, I have wonderful, capable colleagues who look after the operational side of security for a company. But my focus is on product security and most specifically sort of engineering security into the product development lifecycle. Because as you know, and I think most of us know, it's not something that you can wake up and say, hey, I'm shipping product tomorrow. Dang, I forgot about security.
Right, or can't
so
we just
really
sprinkle some crypto
it's
on it?
A cultural change that you have to embed within the fabric of your organization.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's rare to have the CSO of such a large, important corporation be so, directly focused on software security. So that's a good thing. I wish other people would emulate that.
How? I'm kind of backed into it, but I really like it. It's a very interesting area and very timely. I tell people my real goal in life is to be out of a job. it's true because you want to get so good at this that people don't need minders anymore. I mean, I'd love 5 years from now for us not to be talking about software assurance because everyone does it.
Right.
Wouldn't that be great?
That would be great. It would also be impossible. So you have an MBA, which is interesting, and I wondered how your MBA has helped you with your security career and how you got started in security in the first place.
Well, the MBA actually does help, not because I'm necessarily running around talking about market segmentation to everybody, but in the sense that there are a couple of really good concepts that I do try to apply, and a lot of them came from things like optimization classes and actually the economics classes.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, it amused me about 3 or 4 years ago when I heard another vendor, a large one, say, well, no one's going to pay more for security. And my comment was, and this is actually based on a NIST study around 2002, I think you're probably familiar with, about what's the cost of bad software.
Right, yep.
$60 billion a year, up to $60 billion a year. And my comment was, well, people are already, it's not so much they're going to pay more for good security, they're already paying for bad security. They just don't know what they're paying for it. And that's so I talked about the economics of economic term externality.
Mm-hmm.
So I do look at security in sort of a different way, and I do think that actually brings something to the table when we talk about how do we do things, why do we do this versus that.
Right. So, people have made a lot of hay about this idea that security is risk management. And I think from a business perspective, that's just kind of hit you in the face obvious. Something that a lot of security people had a hard time understanding if they had only a technical background. And one would imagine that business also helps you get a grasp on risk management in a new way.
Well, it also does, frankly. There are a lot of people who are very well-intended and very sharp who come up with a laundry list of 8,000 good things we should do in security
mm-hmm.
and all these things we should be doing and all these metrics, and that's all great. But then I look at it and say, all right, but you have to think about, what is the benefit for the cost of getting that information?
Mm-hmm.
and again, opportunity cost, what could I do with the same resources that would lead, that would have a bigger payoff?
Exactly.
Because let's face it, resources are constrained. Even if you're trying to do something better in security, and we all are, one of the things I think that the do-gooders, and I'm in this case I mean it in a good sense, need to do is kind of help people figure out what are the most important things to do first where they're going to get the biggest bang for the buck.
Right.
Because every one of us, no one's going to have a perfect development life cycle.
That means measurement and kind of linking things to real economic impact, both positive and negative, which I think a lot of technical people are lost when they try to do. I know I've been having issues trying to train my guys to not just say, hey, buffer overflow on foo.c, you know, instead say, hey, if we don't fix this, we're going to miss our Q1 number. And that's the sort of insight that I think is very helpful in computer security.
So you'd also ask sort of how did I get into security?
Yeah.
And I did sort of back into it. But it's really interesting for, as obviously, you know, we're having this conversation. I still like it. When I started at Oracle, I started working on our packaged applications, and I did that for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had an opening in a group called Secure Systems, which happened to be building, it was a higher assurance version of a database called Trusted Oracle, and we were building it for the military.
Right.
Because it would handle classified data. You know, you could label the data, and the label would stay with the data, and it enforced the old Bell-LaPadula security model.
Yep.
And it was a great product, but the reason I went into that group, I'd been sort of watching them for a while, I thought, okay, they're building software for the military. I understand paranoid mindsets, because I was in the military, and that looks really cool. And I and one of the things that sort of keeps me in security isn't just sort of who we build this stuff for, which includes military and intelligence, and that's not the only group that matters, but that certainly does matter. It's other aspects of security, like the, you know, social policy implications or ethics,
right,
around it. When we have these discussions about disclosure, which is almost a religious argument, at some point you want to step back and say, well, you know, what really is the right thing from an ethical standpoint, not just a what's going to make me look good in E-Week this week.
That's right. In fact, I was going to ask you about that later, but we might as well segue to that now. I know that you have some interesting perspectives on the use of outside hackers in a security program and full disclosure and all that jazz. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your perspective on, you know, these researchers who out people?
Well, I'm not the short of, I hope there's an industry that we're past sort of the polemics around a lot of these things, and we can actually have, you know, non-religious discussions about all these areas.
Mm-hmm,
so security researchers are part of the ecosystem, and in a lot of cases that can be a very constructive thing.
Right.
In some cases and some individuals, it isn't a constructive thing, and I think that's a fair statement. So I don't want to demonize everybody who's in third party because for a lot of reasons. Part of it is not every company, let's say you're a startup and you've got a great idea. You may not have great security expertise in-house.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing to say it's a bad idea to go hire somebody to give you a bootstrap in what am I not doing right. And that could be anything from somebody coming in and teaching a class to just combing through your code.
Exactly.
Ideally, it would be something where there was some lasting knock-on value and you're not actually outsourcing security full-time, because I don't think that's really in any organization's interest.
I'm totally with you on that one.
So I don't necessarily have a problem with that. We have an in-house ethical hacking firm.
Yeah, I know. You also have a chief hacking officer, right?
Yeah, somebody asked me, what's the definition of ethical hacking? I said, well, if they break into the HR system, they can change my title but not my salary. That's ethical. I've got to be CSO. Okay. And we do, and they're great. They're absolutely wonderful. I will put them up against any third-party firm, and in fact, they do. We actually find the bulk of vulnerabilities in our products ourselves, mm-hmm. not using some combination of our own guys and, of course, automated tools.
Well, and you're certainly in the best position to do that. One would hope you know more about your own stuff than anybody else.
And that's the size. I mean, big honking code base. Just the database is like 60 million lines of code now.
Right.
So we actually have used outside firms from time to time, and sometimes it's to handle overflow. We have more people who want their products assessed than we have internal resources to do it.
Of course, yeah.
So occasionally we use an outside firm, and sometimes we want to make sure that he's or some hacking trend, or sorry, I have to train myself, research trend that we haven't caught on to.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm not necessarily against it. It's sort of, but the one thing I tell people when I talk to them about this is, look, you can't, if you're going to hire an external person, you cannot create trust with a contract.
Right.
In other words, if this is somebody who likes to release exploit code on a whim, you should not be doing business with them, because you're not going to be able to, you know, create a trustworthy relationship, and you're not going to have a contract that's enforceable.
Right, and you shouldn't be surprised if they do that to you.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Hello.
Especially if you're a big company, if you try to enforce a contract, then what's the headline going to read? Big, bad, mean old vendor picks on security researcher who's just trying to make their product better. Like, well, wait a minute, that's not what happened here.
Right, right. Well, I remember 10 years ago when it was a little bit more difficult, because when we were breaking Java, for example, in the mid-90s, turns out we weren't doing that to just garner reputation, but we had a hard time making Sun and Microsoft and Netscape even, you know, acknowledge that they had issues in the beginning. But I think things have changed a lot since 1996.
Well, that's what I said. I hope we're past the polemics, because I think most companies are more aware of security. Certainly some of that's part of the nature of the business has changed. Certainly there have been more exploits out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the landscape has changed. It's not even for better or for worse. It's probably some of both, but we are where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I do, when some of these discussions come up about, hey, I'm going to full disclosure to out the vendor, I kind of say, well, I'd be very surprised if there were vendors who weren't more responsive. So at least you can get past the don't publish everything before they have a chance to fix it, just because you want to, you know, make sure they pay attention to this.
Right.
I would find it to be a rarity that somebody wouldn't pay attention.
I agree with that these days. I think a decade ago it was different, but you're right. We should get past that polemic. So you were at the helm during the famous or infamous Unbreakable campaign. Was there interesting fallout inside the company and the security organization?
Well, I don't. It sounds like a strange thing to say. I mean, I think most people who work in security would say, "Hey, you know what? You know, why would you say something like that?"
Right.
Well, first of all, it wasn't my. It certainly wasn't my idea.
I'm sure.
I did have to defend it. Well, yeah, it's true. I actually did send a note to the IT guy who ran our firewalls.
Uh-huh.
I think my email was something like "brace for incoming."
Yeah, ready not here it comes.
but you know, it actually did have a positive effect in a couple of ways, and I find it strange to say that, but. Well, one of them was, first of all, it's a very strong statement, and when we certainly when we first started talking about it, we had it applied in particular context,
mm-hmm.
and it was around the fact that we'd done all these security evaluations for our product, the database, and at the time, I think our competitors had done 0 and 1, and we had like 14 or 15 of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some proof points. It's like, look, we spent, you know, bazillions of dollars to have somebody else validate our security, and our competitors haven't done this, or they've only done it sporadically.
Right, so you were wanting to talk about that.
So it gave me a chance to talk about assurance.
Yep.
And that's obviously near and dear to my heart. So that was a very positive thing.
Yep.
The other positive thing was that it's not that I didn't have a pretty good amount of authority, but it really did give me a nice big stick to beat developers with if I needed to, because
right.
Nobody wanted to be the team that made Unbreakable breakable.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it turned out to be something very constructive. Overall, I think it was a positive to go through that, and it actually helped our security efforts.
Oh, that's very interesting. So over the last decade, there's been a pretty large evolution in software security, kind of starting from philosophy and noise making, you know, the bug parade, do-do-do-do-do, to action. And I wondered how the Oracle approach to software security has evolved over that decade.
Well, fortunately, there are things that we have now that we didn't used to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really grateful. You know, it's not, as much as I'm happy, my only caveat here is I do see people moving from, you know, for example, common criteria is not perfect. Let's just dump it and let's test our way to security.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, okay, common criteria needs improvement. I will be the first to say that. I'm probably not the first. But I think if we move to a model of just run automated tools against your product and we're done, that's not right either, because it won't find, those tools will not find things like design defects.
Absolutely.
They have got no buffer overflows,
yep.
Eha, But as it turns out, I don't do any authentication, access control, or auditing either.
Right.
So that's not good.
In fact, we've found in our work, and Mike Howard has found in Microsoft in his work, that if you divide up bugs and flaws, it's about 50-50. I would assume that you guys have the same division in your defect pile as well.
Well, that's a good question. I haven't actually looked at those metrics recently. I think we tend to look at them by qualifying categories of things, so that I can focus. Well, you know, what are the biggest categories? We can go after those first.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, you know, one of the things that changes, yes, we use more automated tools now because they are automated tools now.
Yeah.
Now some of them we developed ourselves. We had a perfectly lovely fuzzer now called Byte Rotter that we use to trash our own code.
Right.
We've licensed a few things, so that's really helpful because even the very best developer in the world, I mean, I keep thinking about this one development team, and bless their hearts, this is several years ago, once they figured out what a buffer overflow was, they went through their code, combed through it to, you know, look everywhere for these things and get rid of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they missed one check on input validation.
That'll do it.
That's right. You know, and what am I going to do? Yell at them? You weren't perfect? No, I really appreciated that instead of just fixing the exact manifestation that somebody reported, they really tried to fix the bug the right way.
Yeah, that's good.
But, you know, having had an automated, if we'd had an automated tool then, it might have found, you know, what they missed.
Right.
So that's actually, so yes, we used more automated tools. We have more structure in place in the sense that, you know, we obviously have made a lot of acquisitions. So one of the things we didn't do a few years ago because we weren't making so many acquisitions is figure out how do we fast track these acquisitions. In other words, everything from get a handle on what are they doing in terms of secure development processes, what commitments have they made for things like evaluations, what tools are they using, to how do we get them into our compliance program as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot more structure around that because what I want to do is have very good consistency across every single development group. Okay, here's what we think of as our secure development life cycle. Are we making sure that everybody is doing all this stuff or perhaps is tailored to individual development groups so that we can say every single product we have, whether it's something we built or we acquired, we're consistently doing the same sorts of things.
Yeah, that's good. So it appears then that you guys have the equivalent of Microsoft's SDL or the OWASP CLASP or Sigital's Touchpoints in-house at Oracle?
Well, what I think we have is good development processes that we also have embedded a lot of security into, and some of that had already been there.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, and this is one of the things I try to impress upon people. In a way, we had some advantages because when we, you know, Oracle's claim to fame, aside from, you know, building the first commercial relational database, was that we ran all these operating systems. That was kind of a new thing with the time the company was getting going.
Right.
People didn't port to so many things, and we port to almost everything.
Yeah.
Fujitsu Coffee Master, we run on that. But in order to do that, it means that you have a certain amount of discipline and development because your code has to be portable, you have to be able to test it, you have to be able to do things consistently and come out with product at the same time. So we had a fair amount of rigor around development processes, and there are things that we did to, you know, make things consistent on all those operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave us a lot of rigor, in a way, a rigorous process to plug into when we kept doing security overlay.
Right.
And, of course, even with security, you know, you start by building, our first customer was CIA. So we did sort of think about security 30 years ago when we were building this stuff for them.
Right. So so I wanted to ask you, actually, in your experience, if you had to step way back and squint and look low res at best practices that you add to your regular development process, what do you think the top two best practices would be that you would recommend everybody ought to be doing and you've been doing for a while?
Oh, you know, that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure I get a great answer for that. I mean, I don't feel qualified to talk about general best development practice because, hey, anybody who's seen me write code knows I'm not coding challenged. The one thing I think I hate to say that we have to do this, and this is my new jihad, if I can use that word.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, everybody really has to have some training in secure coding practice now.
Right. Yep.
Because they don't get it in universities.
Yep.
So if you don't do it, why would you do this? Well, people are not going to be perfect coders when they're done with your class, and probably it won't be the only class they take.
Right.
but at least you will have gotten the awareness up. So the next time somebody sits down to write something, maybe their first thought's going to be, wait, there's an API for this, or wait, I need to think about these things.
Yeah, or geez, I need to take the attacker's perspective.
Where's that website where I can look at more information?
Absolutely, yep.
And the one thing I would really like to change, so is that best? Why is that best practice? Well, part of it is you have to, because mm-hmm. even really smart programmers don't get this in universities.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would like to do is change it. We keep talking about the supply chain of software, and customers are now asking their vendors more about how they build products.
Oh, in fact, they are.
Great.
That's great, yeah.
Vendors need to go back to their universities and say, you need to fix this. And we've done that, actually. We sent letters to the top, whatever it is, top 10 or top 15 places we recruit from. In a nice, polite, professional way, we said, look, it costs us and customers a lot of money to fix avoidable, preventable defects in software.
Yep.
And the key words there are avoidable and preventable.
Sure.
And the reason we're having to do this, in part, is because the people we get from your universities don't know this stuff. And you need to change that because it's important. It's not just the cost. It's, hey, it's security of our critical infrastructure.
That's right. I think we've made a little bit of progress in academia over the last decade, but there's plenty more to go. And certainly having you guys and other potential employers writing those letters helps a lot. So that's a cool thing.
What I'm sort of thinking about doing is it's kind of interesting. I think one of my counter, Scott Charney at Microsoft, I think had drafted a letter which a number of assigned probably about two, maybe three years ago to ACM, the accreditation body, and said, you need to fix this problem.
Right.
But what I'm really trying to do is actually get more vendors to send letters to the universities to try to be a forcing function.
Yeah, I think that's going to be better than trying to do it through the ACM. But
so
I've given a copy
of the letter that I wrote to a couple of other vendors. I mean, I took the names of the universities off and said, you are welcome to steal any or all of this.
Yeah, stick it on
your
blog.
Letters.
Yeah, stick it on your blog. That'd be cool.
So that would be one of the best practices. And I certainly think, again, you can't test your way to security. But you ought to at least try to get the junk out of your code, and I think automated tools are really helpful there.
So some sort of code review with this static analysis.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it isn't a substitute for other things. It doesn't. It's not a cure-all. But if nothing else, I think of it again. You know, back to the MBA thing. It's an opportunity cost, because if you could get most of that stuff out of your code more easily, then the same resources that you're spending now on trying to fix them after the fact, you could be spending on something more productive.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be more productive in terms of building functionality you could charge money for, shareholders like that, or you could take those same resources and use it on other aspects of assurance, which would have a bigger payoff. So it's another good reason to do it.
So you have a studied and well-publicized interest in military history, which often leaks nicely into your blog, by the way. How do you think that military history informs computer security?
Well, I think it colors my perspective a lot. In a lot of areas, I'm sort of thinking about what would we do differently going forward, or what could we do differently? Well, one of them, which is only exacerbated by sort of, the network's been deperimeterizing forever.
Right.
But if you actually had, if people developed sort of the way the Marine Corps trains Marines,
mm-hmm.
we would have a lot healthier ecosystem. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, there, as with any of the services, the Marines have areas of specialization. But every Marine is a Marine first, meaning they all know how to fight. And if we had products that self-defended, meaning every product was capable of defending itself instead of saying, there's going to be some fancy little FUBAR appliance out there that's going to block attacks for me.
Yep.
Which gets to be expensive. It doesn't mean you're not going to have other forms of defense. I mean, even the Marines have perimeter defenses.
Uh-huh.
But at some point, the answer to this is not more security products. It's more security in products.
That's right. It's security inside.
So that's part of it. And other things like, this really scares the heck out of me. I think about I've actually used this when I talk to military customers. The military the Defense Department is in the process of trying to put their networks together for an understandable mission reason, which is I want to get my really interesting piece of intelligence information all the way out to the warfighter in the battle space who's probably on a wireless device, and I want to do that much closer to real time.
Yep.
because intelligence has a time to live. Hey, there's a bad guy over on the other side of the hill. He may not be there 10 minutes from now.
Right.
Totally understand that. But I said, but if you're taking away the barriers between those networks that are now physically separated, it means that instead of having nice internal redoubts, there's that military history term, something is defensible, you now have to defend the entire network. It's not defensible.
Yep.
That's kind of a hard problem. But when I look at it that way, like what... So there's a difference. One of the great catastrophes for the British Army was because failure to... they extended their lines and they didn't have any interior perimeter defenses. Ishan Luana, if I said that correctly. The next day, Rorke's Drift, totally different. They created defensive perimeters where there were none.
Right.
I think 11 Victoria Crosses. So yes, it's a very interesting topic and it does affect how I kind of think about some of these issues.
So, and then the last question of all, because it's been interesting conversation so far. When you were 3 or 4, rumor has it that you demanded a library card from your parents.
And I really, God, I can't remember whether, I'm trying to think of, I hope you didn't read blog entries and dig that up. Poor you, having to read all that stuff.
I have people that do that.
Yeah, you know, but funny, that stays with you. My mother said I kind of, what a surprise, I threw a fit. Because I wanted my own library card. Uh-huh. I think it was 3. So I learned to print my name so I could get my own library card. It's funny you mention that, because to this day, when I'm at my home in Idaho, I go to the library every single day.
Yeah, so you're a huge
that library, and
you're
I'm always reading books.
Which books are you reading right now?
You know, I just finished one. I think ought to be required reading for everyone. It's called A Lone Survivor.
Uh-huh.
It's about the... It's a sad commentary in our society when... People know who Lindsay Lohan is dating, but they can't tell you who Michael Murphy or Jason Dunham are. Or Paul Smith, the last 3 military service members who've been recipients of the Medal of Honor.
Uh-huh.
And Michael Murphy was at this firefight. The story of this lone survivor is the last only survivor of the firefight in Afghanistan, and his commanding officer was the last recipient of the Medal of Honor for what he did. He basically stood out in a clearing, made a phone call because the only way he could save his guys.
Yeah, I actually read about that. It got some popular press coverage, but not a lot.
It's a really great read. It makes you really appreciate what these men and women do, and I it's just a fabulous book.
Yeah, cool. Thanks. Well, it's been very interesting chatting with you. I appreciate your time. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The March-April 2008 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine is a special issue devoted to all aspects of identity management. Listeners should also make sure to check out the Building Security In Department. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where Silver Bullet excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.